Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Barack Obama's milestone clean power plan was the heart of the American push to help rein in climate change. Today, the Trump administration is moving to end it. The war against coal, says Trump EPA Chief Scott Pruitt, is over. This is big. This hour On Point, repealing the clean power plan and our climate and energy future now. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you ready for this country to double down on coal now in 2017? Will it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will look at new White House demands for a Dreamer deal. But first, the Clean Power Act. The war against coal is over, says Scott Pruitt. Here he was yesterday in Hazard, Kentucky, announcing he would sign a repeal of the Clean Power Plan today.
The past administration was unapologetic. They were using every bit of power, every bit of authority to use the EPA to pick winners and losers in how we generate electricity in this country. And that's wrong.
And the president's message? Here was Pruitt in Kentucky.
Here's the president's message. The war on coal is over.
But first, well, let's dive right in. Joining us from Washington is Juliet Alperin, senior national affairs correspondent for The Washington Post. You can find her story about all of this at our website, onpointradio.org. Juliet, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
How important was the Clean Power Plan to the Obama-era vision of tackling climate change?
It was central. While they adopted a slew of policies aimed at curbing greenhouse gas emissions, given the role that the electricity sector has in the U.S. as being one of the primary drivers of our carbon emissions, this plan, which aimed to cut emissions from the electricity sector roughly by a third by 2030, was integral to this effort.
Scott Pruitt fought it from Oklahoma when he was attorney general there. Now he's chief of the EPA. He's in Washington. The courts have got a stay on some of the Clean Power Plan already. But how would it have achieved that, or may it still? I don't know. You tell us. But what was its vision of how to achieve that one-third cut in emissions by 2030?
Its vision was to do this, to establish targets for different states who then would be responsible for drafting their own plans to meet those goals. And essentially, it would require utilities to take steps to curb their emissions, both at their plants itself, but also through other ways, through energy efficiency, through installing renewable energy generation. And all of this together would meet those targets. And utilities and, again, attorneys general, such as Scott Pruitt and others, pushed back, arguing that the EPA had overstepped its bounds because it really was only authorized to regulate the facilities themselves, and it couldn't use the Clean Air Act to expand its authority and address carbon emissions through these other ways.
What does the Clean Power Plan envision or imply? What would it have demanded, essentially, in terms of coal-fired power plants in this country? There are a lot of them.
Right. And so what it really would have done is both certainly already there were new pollution controls that were being installed on them. But over time, these would have been phased out. Many of them would have been shuttered. We've already seen, you know, just due to broad economic market forces, no one's building new coal-fired power plants in the United States. They're installing gas-fired power plants. They're turning to, say, solar and wind for new electricity generation. But over time, you would phase out many of these coal plants and instead substitute, whether it's energy efficiency or these other forms of electricity generation. And that's certainly what inspired resistance from a variety of utilities and other players in the business sector.
How important is the Clean Power Plan to the U.S. meeting the goals that it agreed to for emissions reduction in concert with other nations around the country, the Paris Agreement and all that?
Right. Well, it depends how you look at this. So, for example, the cuts envisioned by the Obama administration through this regulation are the main component of meeting that target. That said, there are independent analyses that suggest that we are on track to cut our emissions by between, say, 27% and 35% compared to 2005 levels by 2030. So, in other words, we may get to this point anyway, just through kind of regular economic drivers outside of regulation. But there's no question that the cuts that were dictated through this rule were a main factor in how the U.S. would meet its international climate commitment, which, of course, President Trump has questioned and has started to take steps to roll back.
If the market is going that way anyway, in some significant degree, Juliet, why has there been such fierce opposition to this? Who? What industries? Who has driven it?
Well, that's an excellent question. There are a number of reasons. First of all, while again, you can have market forces that can affect it, I think one of the issues is that there are certain segments of the electricity industry that have invested in coal-fired power plants and have updated them over time. And therefore, what they worry about is what you call stranded assets, that essentially it's pretty cheap to run a coal plant once you have it up and running. And so at this point, there are ones that, you know, there are companies and rural electricity cooperatives and so forth. And if they already have a coal plant, even, you know, if it's 20 years old, 30 years old, it can still run for years after that. And so for them, they would face a real economic loss by having to shut those down. So generally, it's those factors that have the most economic investment in these coal-fired power plants, as well as there's an ideological issue here. There are plenty of conservatives who just don't like the idea of the federal government dictating what we should do on climate change and carbon emissions. And so they would oppose it even if there wasn't an economic issue at stake.
What are the chances? I mean, the Clean Power Plan itself, with Scott Pruitt right in the lead as Attorney General of Oklahoma, was fiercely opposed in the courts. We're already hearing that groups will come forward and oppose this repeal. What are the chances of the repeal going through?
Well, that's another excellent question, and I think it's very hard to predict. As you mentioned, the existing Obama-era rule was stayed by the Supreme Court, and the D.C. Circuit has a case before it right now about its legality. And interestingly enough, the EPA under Scott Pruitt is basically raising the same question that's before that lawsuit. So, you know, in other words, a year ago, you had the administration saying EPA had the right to regulate the emissions in this way, and you had attorneys general saying, no, actually, this is overstepping their authority. Now you have the reverse, where you have the Trump administration putting forth a different legal theory about what the EPA should do. And you have different attorneys general from Democratic states, from Massachusetts, California, Oregon, and Washington now threatening to sue. So you really have the same fight with the players just switching sides. And so how the court ultimately weighs in on this, that will determine whether or not this repeal can go through.
We heard Gina McCarthy, who was EPA chief before Scott Pruitt, EPA chief under Barack Obama, on NPR's Morning Edition today, saying that the Trump administration here is denying science and they're failing to fulfill the role, the mandated legal role of the EPA. Here she was on Morning Edition.
We have an administration that wants to deny the science, and now they're outright denying their legal obligation to protect our kids' health and their future. And so that's what we're seeing here today, not overreach in the prior administration, because the courts were very clear that carbon pollution is a challenge. And if we find that it threatens people, then we have to regulate it. And the science has been very clear.
Gina McCarthy, EPA chief before Scott Pruitt, help us understand the case she's making here. What the court said, it's your job to protect the environment, and science says the environment is threatened, and so act, EPA?
Right. So she's actually referring to a Supreme Court case that goes back a decade, where the Supreme Court said, yes, carbon dioxide is a pollutant and can be regulated under the Clean Air Act. This actually came down during the Bush administration, the end of the Bush and George W. Bush administration. The EPA struggled with how to interpret this. And then in December of 2009, once Barack Obama was in office, EPA issued a finding. It's called the endangerment finding, which meant that, yes, they decided that CO2 is a pollutant that endangers public health and welfare, and EPA was legally obligated to regulate it in some form. What they have struggled with is what is the right way and the legally permissible way to regulate it. And this is one of these cases, you know, you'll be dealing with dreamers later on in your show. Congress doesn't act, and then the executive branch takes action with fewer tools and with less flexibility than, say, Congress. And so what you had is Congress took one swipe at this, passed legislation in the House, it stalled in the Senate. Obama went ahead and through EPA regulated greenhouse gas emissions this way. Now you face the same problem, which is that EPA is now saying it can't regulate carbon dioxide the way it has, but Scott Pruitt isn't proposing pulling back that endangerment finding. And as a result, they will have to figure out a way to tackle this.
Is it weird to you? I mean, we've just seen these huge hurricanes coming through with all that destruction. We've got a summer of incredible wildfires in the West. As we speak, I've got a text coming in from a friend in California outside Santa Rosa. We're safe. Our house filled with family and friends. My brother's home is gone. He's lost everything, but got out as black smoke woke. And this is a text I'm getting as we're talking. We live 10 minutes outside Santa Rosa, which was hit very hard. My friends have lost everything. We're in shock. What has happened? Everyone's sleeping here. We have food and water and beds. We're so grateful to have a safe haven for them here. But who knows? Fire could still go there. Hugs and kisses. This is from California. I mean, is it weird as these things are happening around us, Juliet, to be trying to turn this back, America's central push on tackling climate change?
That's certainly one of the questions that plenty of these people have been raising when you're talking about it. Plenty of these governors from out west have raised this issue and said, our citizens are endangered by some of these climate impacts, and we can't afford not to address it. It's been interesting to see that even with, as you're mentioning, there are these different extreme weather events. Obviously, there are different issues about the connections between drought, wildfire, hurricanes, and climate change. But without question, none of these, some of these things which are climate impacts, some of which might be different, but none of these events have really shifted the political debate here in Washington.
And now, repeal on the table today. EPA Chief Scott Pruitt saying that's the way they'll go with the Clean Power Plan, the heart of the American planned effort under Obama anyway to tackle global climate change. Juliet Alperin is covering all this for The Washington Post. Juliet, great to have you with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about Scott Pruitt's EPA and the Trump administration walking away from, trying to anyway, the Obama-era Clean Power Plan, repealing, killing the heart of the country's plan under President Obama to fight climate change, global warming. Here was Pruitt yesterday in eastern Kentucky.
I'll be signing a proposed rule to withdraw the so-called Clean Power Plan of the past administration and thus begin the effort to withdraw that rule.
You can join us this hour. How do you see this? What's going on here? Are you glad or crazed about the announcement there? The war against coal is over. Is this madness as mega hurricanes rake our shores and California burns? Do you see the scale and implications of what is happening in Washington these days? And will the U.S. be the global laggard, not leader on climate change? Is it necessary for our energy needs to go down this Pruitt path? Joining us right now from Washington is David Doniger, director of the Climate and Clean Air Program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. David Doniger, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
What's your reaction to this repeal effort?
Well, it is shocking and disturbing that just as these, while a hurricane was still pummeling the South, Scott Pruitt went to Kentucky to try to repeal this major effort to curb the pollution that drives this climate change. And he is not meeting his legal obligations under the Clean Air Act, and he's cooking the books on the science and economics.
What do you mean by the cooking the books?
Well, in the package that he's going to release today, we've seen leaked versions of it. They're changing the dollar numbers in the cost-benefit analysis to inflate the costs in a totally phony way and to reduce the benefits in a totally phony way that amounts to denying climate change and denying the health effects of the other pollutants that come from these power plants. The standard way of assessing the value of curbing carbon dioxide is to pay attention not just to what it does here in our country, but what the pollution that drifts all around the world does all around the world. And also, because it lasts in the atmosphere for hundreds of years, to pay attention to what it does to our children and our grandchildren and descendants. Scott Pruitt's going to change the numbers, cook the books. So you only pay attention to about a tenth of all that. You ignore what happens abroad. You ignore what happens in the future. And he does similar things to cook the books on the health effects of the fine particles that come from the pollution, mainly from the coal plants.
David Dunger, we're trying to listen very carefully here to discern whether it sounds like a big step, but whether it is actually a consequential step, because we just heard Juliet Alpern, and you can find easily others saying, well, the markets are going away from coal anyway, so we're going to get quite close perhaps to those emission cuts with or without the Clean Power Plan. What do you say to that assertion?
Well, it's true that the market forces are carrying us in the right direction, but not fast enough. And if anything was wrong with the Clean Power Plan, it's that the previous administration underestimated how far the marketplace was taking things on its own. The Clean Air Act is there for the very purpose of going beyond what the marketplace does to curb dangerous pollution that the markets won't curb by themselves. So we should be strengthening the targets now. We should be aiming for more reductions instead of for rolling it back and having a dirty power plan in its place.
Let's go to Dudley in Millbury, Massachusetts. Dudley, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Mr. Ashbrook. I am concerned about climate change, but saving America's environment by destroying America's coal industry solves absolutely nothing. You know, George Soros is behind the climate change.
Wait a minute. Dudley, I want to hear you up. What do you mean solves nothing? I mean, we have a lot to solve here on the environmental front, right? I want to hear you up, but we can't say solves nothing. That's just... But anyway...
In other words, you save the environment. That's wonderful. But if you're going to throw many thousands and thousands of coal miners out of work and destroy their entire industry, that's in my opinion, that's throwing the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, how do we weigh these two kinds of destruction? Global climate change, and we've all seen the destruction that can come with that, and the threat to some jobs. How do you weigh those, Dudley?
That's the $64,000 question. But what disturbs me even more is that George Soros is behind the climate change movement.
He's not. You know what's behind it? Carbon dioxide that's changing the climate. I mean,
he's pushing the envelope a lot of this, and everyone knows that George Soros is a Jewish financier. And
Dudley, come on. Now you're really leaving my realm there, Dudley. I just don't get that. There is science here. Soros can do what he will. There's science. Heidi in Greenville, Kentucky. Heidi, you're on the air.
Thank you for having me, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. What do you see, Heidi, there in Kentucky? You had Scott Pruitt in town yesterday in Hazard.
No, actually, I'm in South Central Kentucky.
Okay.
But I'm in John Prine territory for context. The problem with declaring the end of the war on coal is that the Trump administration wants to act as if the Obama administration and the EPA is the problem. That's not the issue. China is no longer buying our coal, so it makes no sense to mine coal that's just going to sit in a pile and not go anywhere and not be sold. It doesn't make sense in a business.
But you've still got American plants that are coal-fired. They'll buy coal if it's legally open to them, won't they, Heidi?
That is true. However, the TVA plants that are in Paradise, Kentucky, they're in the process of shutting down the two coal-fired plants that have been open since the 60s and opening up a gas-fired plant. So it's in the process of switching anyway, even if people say, oh, well, we can still burn it domestically. That does not mean that they need to mine the amount of coal that they had previously because there's no market to sell it.
Heidi, does your family have experience in the coal business industry?
Yes. My sister was the fourth generation to work in the mines. Well, she didn't work in the mines. She worked in the office in St. Louis for Patriot. But my grandfather was the eastern director of Peabody Coal Company. So this is a subject very close to my heart.
So we just had a caller saying he's worried about people who work in the coal business. What about that? Do you see Scott Pruitt as coming to their rescue or as missing the boat? Or how do you look at it, Heidi? You're in Kentucky.
Well, my dad still works in coal, actually. However, more people in America work for Arby's than they do in the coal industry anymore. And it's kind of like a, you know, bait and switch sort of thing where we say we're going to save your jobs. There really aren't that many jobs. It's just a grandstanding position for the administration to be able to say, you know, oh, we're going to save your jobs. Well, they don't really employ that many people anyway. It's a few and far between occupation.
More people work at Arby's. You mean the sandwich, fast food chain?
Yeah, more people work for the fast food chain Arby's than they do in the mining industry now.
Okay. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but that's a potent image. Heidi, I appreciate your call from Kentucky. David Doniger, please stand by in Washington at the Natural Resources Defense Council. Not at all happy about this move. I want to bring Jim Matheson into our conversation right now from Arlington, Virginia. He's former Democratic Utah congressman. He's CEO of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Jim Matheson, welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks, Tom.
I grew up with the Rural Electric being very important in my community, lived on a small farm, and they brought electricity to us. That was a century ago. Or getting on toward a century ago. How do you look at what's happening right now with this repeal of Clean Power Plan? You're for it. Why, Jim?
Well, it's really about how we serve our members and having the flexibility to do it in a way that isn't disruptive to our members. We believe that the Clean Power Act the Clean
Plan.
Air Act is really structured in a way. The Clean Air Act is structured where the EPA can look at a plant-specific issue, but we think they exceeded their authority when they did industry-wide standards. Litigation resulted that based on the Obama Clean Power Plan doing that. Supreme Court issued a stay so that issue could be considered. Of course, that issue ended up going to the D.C. Circuit Court, and now it's been held in abeyance, and that litigation process is at a standstill. But we think for us, what we're looking for is an opportunity for our members to make a local decision about what makes sense for them. And some of our co-ops, electric co-ops are a little different than the big investor-owned electric utilities. We don't have a fleet or a large portfolio of power plants that a particular co-op owns. We may own two or three plants, and we've made significant investments in one based on government regulation.
Jim, may I slow you down for a second because I want to catch up with you. So you provide power to largely a rural population. And you own power plants that do that. And I guess you're saying among those power plants, you have coal-fired power plants.
We have coal plants. We made significant investments in them in the last few years based on other environmental regulations. And if you shut those plants down, those plants aren't depreciated. The debt still exists. And we're not investor-owned. We're co-ops that are owned by the members. So all the impact of the cost is going to go to our consumers. We're looking for flexibility to make sure our consumers aren't hit with a significant cost.
Can you not move into wind or solar or nuclear, any other alternative? I don't know.
We have a large portfolio, and we are moving into all kinds of different technologies. What I'm saying is there's a transitional issue here where if you shut down a plant that's got a bunch of debt on it from recently new equipment that was put on based on other regulations like the mercury standard, which we did, spent hundreds of millions of dollars on that, how do you pay that debt off if you have to go out and shut down the plant and buy power someplace else at the same time? That's the issue, is this transitional issue. And quite frankly, a rulemaking process through the EPA can't address that. Congress needs to address that.
David Doniger, what do you say about that very real concern of Jim Matheson and his rural population that needs power?
Well, first, as Jim acknowledged, rural co-ops are a diverse lot, and a lot of them have been diversifying their portfolio. And those that haven't have been a little slow on the ball. They get government assistance as well as payment from their co-op members. There are things that in the Clean Power Plan that were aimed at giving a lot of flexibility to states to how they would distribute the burden between the power plants in their states. And all of these things could be handled. Go back to the previous callers, what rural America needs is investment to help it get into the clean energy economy. That's where the job growth is. 550,000 new jobs in clean energy would have been triggered if the Clean Power Plan were fully carried out. And many of those jobs would be in rural areas. And in fact, we're working closely with Jim's organization on some energy efficiency initiatives, too. So there's ways we can cooperate, but we can't just let this dangerous pollution continue unabated. Scott Pruitt does not have a plan to clean things up. He has a plan to leave things as they are or roll them back.
We're looking at the Trump administration's move to repeal, kill the Clean Power Plan, the heart of this country's once planned moves to fight climate change. Let's go to Leo in Akron, Ohio. Leo, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
This fictional war on coal is such a joke. Like it's been said before, the market is already picking the winners. But the effects of climate change aside, if you're pro-coal, that means you're also pro-asthma. And the health costs associated with these coal-fired power plants is enormous. I mean, where's the responsibility for that? Are they looking at the, as far as cost analysis of any of this, is that playing into any of these decisions at all?
Leo, we've got it, and I can already hear David Doniger saying that's being ignored here, but, you know, you've got other interests as well, and Jim Mathis is representing them. Meg in Chicopee, Massachusetts. Meg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just thinking about what I learned when I was in school. A very young girl. I got children now. But I remember being taught that democracy meant the greatest good for the greatest number. And I don't see what's going on with the coal plants and a lot of other things as being that. It seems to be the greatest good for the smallest number. I don't know. You know,
Meg, our time is short. Let me pick it up right there. Jim Matheson, how about it? Democracy means the greatest good for the greatest number. You're representing a particular population, but you can hear callers calling in and worried that staying reliant on coal is got negative effects for a very large number of people, maybe for the whole planet if the whole planet sticks on that path. How do you feel about that, Jim?
Well, again, I think that there's there are things going on in the marketplace that even among, I can tell you among co-ops, our amount of generation from coal has dropped 9% in the last 2 years. We're looking at different opportunities for greater efficiencies, greater use of electric vehicles, which we think could have a more significant impact on, a significant impact on reducing emissions. There are a lot of tools in the toolbox in the marketplace is driving us in a lot of those directions. That's what we ought to be talking about is the different choices out there for fuel diversity and opportunities that make sense at a local level. That's really what electric co-ops across the country, we're in 47 different states and they're all in a lot of different circumstances and they want the flexibility do what's right for the folks living in that area.
Alan in Auburn, Alabama. Alan, you're on the air.
Hi. I was just going to comment that I don't think this administration really has any plan of themselves. It's all their whole plan is politics on reversing the previous administration's efforts to fight climate change.
Maybe so. They won the election, so should this then be the outcome, Alan?
Well, I think it's an administration of trolls. Like everybody that's been put in place, you look at people like in education, Betsy DeVos, someone who's never gone to public school herself, Scott Pruitt at the EPA. I mean, he spent his whole life fighting the EPA almost. I mean, his career at least. I mean, it's an administration of trolls. Their whole goal is just to undo what the previous administration did.
Alan, I appreciate your call. David Dungar, are you that cynical about this administration?
Well, this I can tell you this. The climate change problem is going to last longer than this administration. And the Clean Air Act is going to outlast this administration. And that's why people in the electric industry, including in the co-ops, are thinking about this in the longer term. And they're not thinking that this that this turn from Trump and Pruitt will really last, they have to make investment decisions that carry over 10, 15, 20 years. That's why the market keeps moving in the cleaner direction. We just need to do it faster. The one thing they're not getting out of Trump and Pruitt is regulatory certainty. It's just chaos.
Do you think this repeal will go through, David? It's going to be fought also in the courts, I guess.
Either now or later, there's going to be a day in court over these misinterpretations, these warping of the Clean Air Act and the cooking of the books on the numbers. And the court's going to look at it really hard, and I don't think Pruitt's going to win.
Jim Matheson, do you have a clear signal here, given the court challenges likely to come to Scott Pruitt's moves today?
Well, I think this is not the end, that it's a repeal. There's going to be a process to define something that would replace it. We'd certainly like something that has some consistency and clarity for the long run. This is an industry that is involved in a lot of capital-intensive investments that take the long term. So having durability and consistency over time matters to people in the electric industry. And there is going to be, as I understand, a process to look for a replacement to this rule. We just want to be consistent with protecting reliability in the electric grid, which I don't think gets talked about enough. We want it to take a look at what costs are going to be consumers. We want to have clarity and certainty for the long run.
Jim, we're out of time right there, and I apologize for it, but that's the clock. Jim Matheson, CEO of National Rural Electric Cooperative Association, thank you for joining us, and David Doniger at the NRDC. When we come back, we're going to look at DACA, the Dreamers, and what the White House wants in order to save them. This is On Point. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. Sunday night, the White House unveiled a laundry list of tough immigration moves, including funding a border wall and a crackdown on unaccompanied minors fleeing Central America, that it wants in exchange for a deal to save DACA. The move comes after Democrats thought they had reached a deal on protecting Dreamers last month. We're going to look at that standoff now, and you can join us. Do you see the makings of a deal here, or not at all? Last month, President Trump reached a tentative agreement, or so it seemed, with Democratic leaders Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi that would have protected the, what, about 800,000 Dreamers in exchange for some border security measures, but not, we thought at the time, or he suggested, the border wall. Here's the president on Air Force One after that confab with the Democrats last month.
Chuck and Nancy would like to see something happen, and so do I. And I said, if we can get something to happen, we're going to sign it, and we're going to make it. They're going to make a lot of happy people.
That was then. Sunday night, the White House unveiled a list of demands it wants in exchange for a legislative fix on DACA, which it has said will expire, put a six-month clock on it. Here's White House Legislative Director Mark Short in a conference call with reporters Sunday.
These priorities are essential to mitigate the legal and economic consequences of any grant of status to DACA recipients. They fulfill the president's promise to advance immigration reform. It puts the need of American workers first.
And it's a long, tough list. Dreamers looking at this, here's Christina Jimenez, co-founder of United We Dream, which wants to extend and expand DACA's protection, told NPR's All Things Considered yesterday that the White House is using Dreamers, their lives, as leverage in these immigration negotiations.
Our lives are at stake, and the lives of thousands of immigrant youth that have been protected by the DACA program are at stake. Is immoral and it's unacceptable, and we will refuse to be used as bargaining chips.
But they would appear to be bargaining chips right now. Let's look at the demands and where this might or might not go. Joining us from Miami, Florida, is Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Washington is Seungmin Kim, who covers Congress for Politico. Seungmin Kim, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you both. Alan, first, what's the White House asking for in return, effectively, for finding some kind of deal to let the Dreamers stay?
Everything. I mean, this, what they put out Sunday night was the wish list that every sort of hardline immigration group has been pushing out there for decades. You've mentioned the border wall. You've mentioned the crackdown on unaccompanied minors coming from Central America. But this also includes 10,000 more Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents to arrest undocumented immigrants. It calls for hiring 370 new judges to more quickly deport those undocumented immigrants. It calls for an end to chain migration, which is the ability for somebody in the United States to sponsor one of their relatives overseas. It completely overhauls our legal immigration system to switch it from a predominantly family-based system to an economic-based system. And, you know, we can go on this. And that's I think, why a lot of these Democrats who were working with the White House these last couple of weeks are suffering from whiplash today, because they thought they were getting somewhere. They thought they'd kind of crafted at least the broad outlines of a bill. And then all of a sudden the White House comes back like this, and boom, they give every single demand that they've ever had on immigration. And it takes us all the way back to sort of campaign Trump when he was pushing that incredibly hard stance.
So, Kim, how do Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, how are they responding to this? Did they really think they had a deal with the president which wouldn't require a border wall and certainly not this very long list of demands? Did they think they had it? Do they feel betrayed or blindsided, or they saw this coming?
Well, Chuck and Nancy are not pleased right now, to say the least. They did, Leader Schumer and Pelosi really did think they had a sort of this handshake agreement with President Trump on what to do for these dreamers. It would be the DREAM Act, which would provide a pathway to citizenship for young undocumented immigrants who came to the United States as minors, and paired with some border security measures, you know, not a wall, but perhaps, beefing up security provisions such as, you know, more technology at the border, reinforcing existing fences. There were some ideas tossed around. So this came, we had seen leaks over the last several days leading up to Sunday night's announcement that the principles would take a much dramatic turn to the right in terms of what the administration was seeking. But this was, the Democrats really thought there was an agreement. Republicans even had started to kind of look at the framework that the Democrats had laid out and said, look, here is our legislation for Dreamers. Let's see what border security measures can be paired with that. And then all of a sudden, this came, and Democrats say this is really a non-starter. And remember that Democrats do hold a lot of leverage here, because one, you need 60 votes to advance basically any legislation through the Senate. And two, the Republican Party is really divided on immigration reform. And while a lot of Republicans are generally sympathetic to the plight of these Dreamers, a lot of Republicans aren't, and they said they're not going to support anything that remotely resembles amnesty.
So, but who's really got the leverage here? I mean, it does look as though, from one angle, that the Democrats are now over a barrel. They're going to say no, and what, have, Homeland Security, you know, start marching Dreamers south across the desert?
Well, if the president really wants a deal on Dreamers, then I do think Democrats do still hold some leverage here. But I think that's kind of been the trick, or the kind of the puzzle in the last several days, trying to figure out what the intentions are. And you've had some advocacy groups and lawmakers telling us that this is a sign that perhaps maybe they really don't want a deal, and they are perfectly fine with letting the futures of, you know, nearly 700,000 current DACA beneficiaries just kind of, you know, disappear and put them back at risk of deportation. Democrats who have really pushed for a solution on this kept reaching to President Trump's rhetoric over the last year, where he did seem very conflicted over the future of these Dreamers, saying, I want to treat these kids with great heart. They contribute to our country. Now you have the Ivanka Trump weighing in last night and saying, we want, Congress needs to step in and find a long-term fix for these Dreamers who do benefit, the United States and the economy. But again, you have other top-ranking officials in the White House, such as Stephen Miller, his top domestic policy advisor, who have taken very hardline immigration policy in the past, and it's yet to be seen which kind of vision from the White House emerges at the end of the day.
Two faces from Donald Trump. Here was one last month. A reporter asked him a question.
Should Dreamers be worried?
We love the Dreamers. We love everybody. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we love everybody, but. September 22nd, campaign rally in Alabama. Here was the president.
The wall is happening, folks, okay? Believe me. The wall is happening.
Alan Gomez, who I don't even know where to begin here. First of all, Washington has talked about wanting comprehensive immigration reform for a long time. You say, here it is. This is the whole laundry list. This is a vision of immigration reform. So who's got the leverage here if the Dreamers' fates are on the line?
It's difficult because we're trying to have this, you know, usually when they talk about comprehensive immigration reform and trying to enact a lot of the priorities that they're talking about here, that's a very long process. That takes a very long time. Sung Min and I were both in all those committee hearings back in 2013 when the last time that they tried to do this, and that took half a year for just the Senate to get that thing passed. There's so many parts of this laundry list that there's widespread opposition from the Democrats. There's depending on which piece of it, there's a lot of opposition from Republicans. Budget hawks don't necessarily like spending billions of dollars on the border wall and millions more for more agents. There's more moderate Republicans that don't want to kick out Dreamers and these unaccompanied minors coming from Central America. And there's many Republicans who really oppose this idea of completely overhauling our legal immigration system. So there's great division within the Republican Party there. And it comes back to Trump. And Tom, we've talked about this a few times, that it's just impossible to really know what's going on in Trump's head on this. Years ago, he was for the Dreamers as a campaigner. He was against them. After he won election, he talked about treating them with great heart, and then we've seen this incredible back and forth in just the last couple of weeks, culminating with this morning. He sends a tweet saying that Democrats don't want secure borders, they don't care about the safety for the United States of America. And so I think anybody in Congress trying to get a bead on what's going on in the White House, whether Miller's the one running the show behind the scenes, whether Trump is going to end up pushing for some kind of fix for the Dream Act, it just makes it very hard for any of them to try to get together and say, okay, what kind of package, what kind of pieces of this proposal are we going to grab onto and really try to push?
Well, very tough demands on the table right now. Our listeners are paying close attention. Let's go to Des Moines, Iowa. Laura, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Great show today. Just last night, I was attending a city council meeting here in Des Moines where organizations that support Dreamers and immigrants and their allies are pushing our city to declare resolution for sort of like a sanctuary city.
Okay.
Basically just so these people know they can go to the cops if they need help. They're not going to be, you know, their information's not going to be shared with ICE and things like that. And I think, you know, we can't trust the government in Washington right now.
But what's the mood in Des Moines? Do you sense a mood, Laura, that people want to bend over backwards to help the Dreamers? Or are they lining up with this tough list of immigration demands from the White House now?
Well, I think Iowa and Des Moines are two separate things. Now, we do have a lot of farming, and there are a lot of immigrants that come to do farming in Iowa. So I think you might go to the rural areas and find some different opinions among farmers who may even be, you know, conservatives and have their ideas about immigration. But here in Des Moines, it's a pretty blue area, and there's a lot of support for our immigrant brothers and sisters. And Iowa has a great history of welcoming all kinds of refugees, Bosnian, Sudanese, the Hmong people after Vietnam. So I think, you know, the heartland does care, and we want to see some changes, and that's going to happen November 6, 2018.
So you're waiting for another election cycle. That's a while to wait. The Dreamers it was 6 months to DACA being ended. That's down to 5 now. The clock is ticking on their fates, and this deal, maybe no deal, now sits on the table. Let's go to San Antonio, Texas. William, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. I think the deal is an excellent deal. It gives the Democrats what they want concerning the Dreamers, and it gives the Republicans what they want concerning good, solid, safe borders. You know, people talk about the agricultural industry. Well, the reason the agricultural industry can only get illegal immigrants is because they don't pay overtime. They don't.
Yeah, William, we're losing you, but you're breaking up, and I think we got the idea. Alan Gomez, let me bring that to you. Good deal. Looking on from San Antonio, a little distance from Washington. You know, Dreamers stay, wall goes up, everybody's happy. What do you say, Alan?
Well, I mean, I think both those calls actually raise a really important point here. In Iowa, they're having a very intense debate over sanctuary cities and what the proper role for them to be should be. As the caller from Texas was talking about, you know, we get into the guest worker program there and whether workers from other countries are coming in and taking away American jobs. And the point I'm making is that each of those in and of themselves are incredibly difficult, painful, emotional arguments to have, which is what makes we'll give you Dreamers for all 18 of these policy proposals, which that's what makes it so hard to get something like that passed.
It's not just a wall. It's much more. It goes right to the heart of the immigration as we've known it.
Exactly. And so trying to get through that, you know, all 18 points and settle all those in a way that both chambers of Congress can approve is just, I can't imagine that happening in 5 months, you know, let alone 5 years.
So, I mean, how do you look at it then? Because they've put this on the table. The clock is ticking already on documents. It expires in now 5 months. They put the demands out there. Do they want a solution before our caller from Iowa says we'll wait for the next election, 2018? Do they want a solution or do they want this as a live political issue then? Will the Democrats do a deal? Or, I mean, people even talking about a government shutdown in December to protect the Dreamers. Talk to us.
Democrats have indicated that they do want a deal and they are willing to give on some of these border security measures that we've discussed earlier. But now that we've seen what the White House's priorities are on immigration, at least as their opening bid, you've seen Democrats increasingly talk up more of these hardline tactics that you just referred to get, a legal status for Dreamers soon. First of all, they want this resolved before the end of the year, even though we do have technically until early March to resolve this issue, which complicates other legislative items that the Hill wants to accomplish, including tax reform, when Republicans have said this immigration is important, but we're going to do tax reform before we handle the immigration issue. But after we saw these principles, you have members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus saying that we're going to put all the options on the table. We may not vote for government spending bills until we get a DACA solution. And that matters because, you know, Speaker Paul Ryan in the House and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in the Senate have had to routinely reach out to Democrats for their votes on legislation, basically to keep the lights on the federal government. Yeah. So if Democrats really do follow through on this threat, and it is smaller chatter right now, Leader Nancy Pelosi said it's kind of too early to talk about those kind of tactics. But if that call increases among Democrats, both in the House and the Senate, then we could see serious problems in December.
Alan, how do you picture this potentially playing out? The clock's ticking. People's lives are on the line. So is national policy.
I mean, I think your guess is as good as mine right now, Tom, because it's when we're looking at, again, you have that idea, the fractured Republican Party right now, they're not sure where they want to go on this. Within them, they have very broad disagreements over what the White House put out. Democrats, you know, right now they have one focus, and that's, you know, getting protection for these Dreamers. And then all this is happening with the backdrop of Trump literally going one direction to the next from week to week. I mean, I remember we were talking just a few mm-hmm. weeks ago, right after Trump and Schumer and Pelosi all got together. And I think what I said at the time was, hey, let's wait till next week and see what he says. And sure enough, he's come back in a very, very different direction. So, yeah, we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, I guess you got that piece right, Alan. Here we are. Here we are again. I'm grateful to the two of you for being with us. Sungmin Kim, covering Congress for Political. It's always great to have you, Sungmin. Thank you very much for being with us. And Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today, joining us today from Miami. Alan, great to have you here. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, or wherever you get podcasts. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thanks for listening today. Thanks for all your contributions. This is On Point.